Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Peter Hyatt Show. This is a show about some of the cases that are currently in the news that we take a look at through the lens of statement analysis as well as commentary. We are fortunate tonight to have with us statement analysis author, instructor, and expert Mark McClish. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Peter.
We're going to be talking about the some of the cases that have been a discussion of late, but we'll begin a little bit with a update on the David and Tiffany Hartley case, and then we'll get on to some questions for Mark. Before we went to air, the Denver Post released a article that I think some of you have already come across and have found probably somewhat shocking, in which they spoke to Tiffany Hartley, and she revealed some of her plans for the future, for the near future. This took me by surprise because I've been thinking that with Tiffany Hartley's appearances, we first saw that she was on every network, every program was hosting her, and that she was backed by David's family. And then we saw a change where David's family wasn't appearing quite as often or quite in strong numbers as they were, and then they weren't appearing at all. And I had begun to wonder whether or not, due to her conflicting accounts, each time she told her story, which she called her story, some of the details began to change, in particular regarding where he was shot, the head or the front of the head, the back of the head, the neck, along with other little details regarding the positioning of the boats, et cetera. And if you've been with us the last several weeks, we had first Dr. Lillian Glass came on and spoke about the body language analysis. As many of you know, she teaches body analysis for deception to law enforcement, especially in the California, Los Angeles area. And then last week we had profiler and author Pat Brown on, who gave us some pretty interesting theories. Pat feels that the account that Tiffany is giving did not take place in the water, as she said, but took place literally on land. And she believes that somehow David and Tiffany were involved in drugs, and that she transposed the story from water, from land, where Pat Brown thinks it took place, onto water. And this was fascinating, and I have some questions about that myself regarding Tiffany's reaction post-event. But for those that follow the case closely, you saw today that the Denver Post released an article that she spoke and gave her plans, and her plans include traveling to New York and Los Angeles, where she is going to be on another media blitz. I had assumed incorrectly that an attorney would have said to her, this has got to stop, you've got to stop speaking to people, but she's going forward. And so her plans are revealed. But she also said something that came as a bit of surprise that she'd be this blunt, and I think this may come from someone that speaks a lot, is that she said that she can no longer be reached by the Mexican authorities. She'll put herself out of reach of them by moving to Colorado. They can't get to me here, that sort of thing. So this was a strange article that came out from the Post, and it'll be something worth following up on. We know that she moved. We know that she has talked about moving on with her life very quickly after the alleged death of her husband, and a lot of theories have been floating. But for the most part, mainstream media has declared that her story is true, and she is not being deceptive at all. In fact, we've seen that even the slightest inkling of a question about her story has been shot down. We saw the governor of Texas openly wonder how people could even question her story. We saw the Sheriff Gonzalez from Zapata County declined to give her a polygraph. He said, why should I give her a polygraph? I believe her. So it's been a lot of strange things happening in this case, and now with her latest where she says that she's out of reach. I'm not sure how the jurisdictions work with that, but I think that if Mexican prosecutors are able to put together enough evidence and to attempt to indict or charge her, depending on their laws, I think they can ask the United States to extradite her. So we'll get to that case. And if you have any kind of questions you'd like to ask, you'd like to call in, either questions about this case or other cases for Mark McClish, our call-in number, which I'm looking for here, 1-619-789-4315. So if you'd like to call in, 1-619-789-4315. And again, I'm introducing now Mark McClish. I first came in contact with Mark McClish through his book a few years ago, I Know You Are Lying. Mark, I think I've read your book maybe six times by now. What prompted you to write it?
Just having been in statement analysis and analyzing statements and teaching it for the U.S. Marshal Service when I was a Deputy United States Marshal for about 10 years teaching it. Once I was finished teaching, then I thought, well, I need to share this information. It's just so fascinating, as you know, once you get into it, if you just listen to what people are saying, you can obtain a lot of information from that statement. And it's just amazing how people's words will betray them.
Let's start from the beginning, Mark. What is statement analysis?
Well, statement analysis is analyzing the language that a person uses. It has nothing to do with their body language. We don't need to see the person or hear the person. Just give us a written statement, or even if you were listening to a recording or a telephone conversation, by analyzing the words that people use, we can determine if they're being truthful or deceptive, and we can obtain additional information from that statement. And the reason this occurs is because there are usually several ways you can phrase a statement, and people will always phrase that statement based on all the information they have, and that may include information they did not intend to share. One Christmas season, I asked my friend, what'd you do this weekend? And he said, I went Christmas shopping with my wife. And I said, you didn't want to go, did you? And he said, no. And the reason I knew that was is because of the way he phrased his statement. He said, I went Christmas shopping with my wife. I and wife are separated in that sentence, as opposed to saying, my wife and I went Christmas shopping. There you have wife and I connected with the word and. And he didn't think about, well, how should I phrase this? He just automatically said it the way he felt. And that's what happens even if people are trying to sound convincing. If they're lying, their words will betray them without them knowing it.
Mark, is it admissible in court, just the idea of statement analysis itself?
The techniques, 90% of the techniques are based on the English language. By that I mean word definitions and the rules of grammar. So that portion would be admissible in court. There's only very few techniques, such as the number 3 is a deceptive number, or when people use the phrase, you know, I swear to God, they may be deceptive, that are just based on observations that people such as yourself and police officers have had over the years. But the majority of techniques are based on the English language, so they would be admissible. But what you'll find is you don't need an expert witness to testify that when somebody said, I tried to be truthful, the word tried means they didn't do it. They attempted but failed. An expert statement analysis is better served sitting at the state's table or the prosecutor's table or the defense table, pointing out what the witness is saying from the stand and allowing the attorney then to confront them on it if that would be the best course of action.
I find it fascinating to realize that statement analysis is inevitable. It is something that we all do, and I think one of the biggest projections that I found coming from your book, I Know You Are Lying, is that if statement analysis is inevitable, why not do it skillfully? And what I mean by inevitable is that I'm going to decide when I listen to someone, I'm going to make a decision for myself whether I'm going to listen carefully or not. And you start off with a question where you ask, there are two frogs sitting on a log and one decided to jump off. How many frogs are left? And it's kind of fun to start a seminar though that way, because it gives you a chance to see who's going to shoot their hand up first or yell out the number one quickly when, as you point out, all that we've said is that the frog decided to jump off. We don't know if he went through with his plan or not. We all make decisions and then change our minds later on. And so statement analysis points to what someone actually said and not for interpretation. And so I think that you're going to listen to me, you being a general audience, and you're going to either listen to me, to the words I said, or you're going to interpret what you think I said. And in that case, statement analysis is inevitable. We all do it. It's whether we do it skillfully or not. Have you found any particular cases, Mark, that just really demonstrate the principles well for the public?
Well, I get statements all the time from police officers, you know, investigators asking me to help them out with the case. And I mean, one of the latest ones I got was a statement from a rape victim. And it was a pretty lengthy statement, but one time in that statement, the pronoun we appeared when she was talking about the attacker. And the pronoun we all know means, is a plural pronoun. Several people, at least one or two, were involved, but well, a lot of people don't realize that the pronoun we means there's a partnership. It always means there's a partnership. We may not know how much of a partnership, but one did exist with the pronouns we and us. Therefore, we would not expect the pronoun we to appear in a rape statement or even a kidnap statement. The victim is not going to partner up with her attacker. And that one pronoun, and there were other things in her language that indicated she was making up this story, but the big one was that pronoun we. Most people are going to say, he drugged me into a house, or he forced me into a house, not we went into the house. And those are the kind of things you're looking for, you know, in a statement. When I think we're all familiar with the Scott Peterson case, and when we're talking about somebody who has disappeared, such as his wife Lacey, and on national television, he talked about his wife in the past tense. He said she was amazing. Before her body was discovered. But by talking about her in the past tense, he was telling the whole world, if you were listening, that, hey, I know my wife is dead. She's no longer around. And he caught himself, and after he said she was amazing, he then said she is amazing. Of course, he was eventually convicted of killing his wife and unborn son. And so just by listening to the words that people use, you know, and ask yourself, well, what is this person telling me? And as you pointed out, we can't interpret. None of us can read somebody else's mind, but we simply believe what people tell us. We don't assume anything. We don't assume one frog jumped. We just listen to what the person has said, and if they said that two frogs are sitting there and one decided to jump, then it means just that. Two frogs are sitting there and one has that little cloud thinking about jumping. If you just listen to what people are saying, you'll get a lot more out of that statement.
Well, there is my contention with the idea that someone may think that statement analysis is not a valid science, or it's not something that is a proper tool to be used in investigations, because in any case, would you like, people are listening, are you going to interpret what the person said, or are you going to actually hear what they said for yourself and take their words? One of the things you pointed out was when in the Monica Lewinsky scandal that President Clinton said that he knew that there was an expectation that he would be truthful, and he said, and I tried to tell the truth. If most people would simply interpret that as saying, well, he made his best effort to tell the truth, when really the word tried in the past tense means to have attempted, not completed. I've
Absolutely.
Said many times where I've gone to a ball game and I've come home, and if I said to my wife, you know, honey, I tried to hit a home run for you, or to the kids, I tried to hit a home run for you, they're pretty much on key there, knowing that dad did his best, but he did not hit that home run.
That's
so the
right.
word tried... Yeah, this is not an interpretation. This is an actual listening and following the rules of grammar.
And that word tried comes up a lot. I've done interviews with people where they said to me, you know, I'm trying to be honest. And again, trying means, well, you're not being honest.
What about the expression you mentioned before? I think you said swear to God or honest to God. Was that empirical, or is that something you found on the job, or...
It's more based on, I haven't seen any studies on that. It's based more on observations. When I speak at a seminar, it's usually heavily attended by law enforcement, and most of them will be shaking their head, agreeing with that. And as I tell them, they could probably be a few more phrases they could add to this list that I have. So it's not an absolute, and that's what I tell them. It's just if you hear somebody say, you know, I swear to God, or honest to God, or I swear my mother's grave, I want that light bulb in your head to go off and just take a closer look at that portion of their statement. Are they being truthful, or did they use that phrase to convince you that they're being truthful? You know, I've had people tell me when I was looking for fugitives, you know, honest to God, I don't know where he's at. And that was the only indication of deception in their statement. So therefore, I concluded they were being truthful. They just have a habit of using that phrase. But if that one of those type of phrases appear and then something else appears in their statement and then we have, you know, another thing with their language, then it all starts to add up.
Sure, and I think that's a good point because now we're talking about indicators. We're not talking about declaring someone, this person here is a liar because they said honest to God. But I have found that the same thing in hundreds and hundreds of interviews and then speaking with others is that anytime a statement comes forth and someone brings God into the issue, it has got my attention. That red flag is up, and it may not be the darkest red flag, but my ears are certainly ready to hear more language. And I have found the same thing that in investigations, that when that phrase comes up, I generally will slow down and begin to take the direction of the language it's bringing me. So I found a lot of things in the book interesting. In fact, it's a real page-turner. The famous cases in particular, the Ramsey case. What are your thoughts on that case?
Based on the language of John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey, I believe, of course, Patsy Ramsey is now deceased, but I believe that John Ramsey knows who killed his daughter. I didn't see anything in the language that would indicate that he killed her or Patsy killed her, but I believe he knows who killed her.
Okay. And what about the ransom note itself? I know you've done a lot of work on that, and it's something, in fact, for our listeners, www.statementanalysis.com. Mark has an entire section devoted to famous cases, and I found the analysis of the ransom note to be just an excellently done work. What was it about the ransom note that really indicated to you, besides the obvious that it was, you know, the mother of all ransom notes in length, but what about the linguistic indicators within it?
Well, the Ramseys, in general, first let me say the Ramseys insist that this was a kidnapping that turned into a murder. And if you look at the ransom note, there's a lot of indicators that this was a bogus ransom note. In other words, the perpetrator wrote this ransom note to make it look like a kidnapping that went bad. They start off saying, we respect your business. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. A lot of plural pronouns. We advise you, I think it said, not to contact the police. But then later in the ransom note, we have the statement, I advise you. Or I will, what was it? Oh, yeah, I advise you to be arrested. We have that pronoun, I. And if this was a, even though one person maybe wrote this note, if it was a group effort, they would have the group mentality when use plural pronouns throughout the entire statement. But the one I and one time they used the pronoun my should never be in that ransom note. So right off the bat, just by looking at the pronouns, it tells us there's something wrong with this note. Now, it doesn't mean there's not a kidnapping. The police still need to investigate it, but we know that this ransom note isn't quite what it appears to be.
And who was the small foreign faction?
Right, small foreign faction. I mean, again, if you were a small foreign faction, you wouldn't refer to yourself as a small foreign faction.
And hence, was another word that came out, and hence.
The word hence is not a commonly used word, and then the ransom note had the phrase, as you just mentioned, and hence, and you don't have to use the word and with the word hence. Most people don't. You just simply say hence. And when we looked at the Ramsey's Christmas message that they posted 1 year after JonBenet had died, we find the phrase, had there been no birth of Christ, there would be no hope of eternal life, and hence no hope of ever being with our loved ones again. So we see the exact same wording that appeared in the ransom note. And Patsy Ramsey tried to address this, and I say the word tried, in her book, The Death of Innocence, but she never fully explained how that phrase, and hence, got into their family Christmas message. She never really addressed it. We also had a cross out. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead, Mark.
In the ransom note, we also had a crossed out word. What the writer wrote was, if we arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence a earlier delivery, then they crossed out the word delivery and wrote pick above your daughter. And what they realized is that, well, as a kidnapper, I'm not going to deliver the hostage to you, I'll just tell you where you can find her. So they crossed it out and wrote pickup. But we can sometimes learn from crossed out words where people had a change of thought, and this is an example here, because a true kidnapper would not make that mistake, and Wright will deliver your daughter to you. And so, again, another indication that this was not a real kidnapping, but that somebody wrote this note after JonBenet had died and tried to make it look like a kidnapping.
Another case that you were on top of, really from the beginning, I think that you may have had the first analysis that I saw on the web, at least, Casey Anthony. We had a point where we only knew that a child was missing and that a babysitter or a nanny had taken the child. This is what was reported. And your analysis was up very quickly. And one of the first things that you pointed out was that Casey had said right from the get-go that Kaylee loved the park. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Yeah, she talked about her in her, I think it was her first interview with the detectives, four times she talked about Casey in the past tense. It's very similar to Scott Peterson and other cases. Like you said, she said, quote, she being Casey, she liked to go walking the big trail at the park, but she liked. And then another time she said, yeah, that's something she loved to do, but she used in past tense language, talking about her daughter as if she's no longer alive. And yeah, it had been about a month since her disappearance, but most people are still going to hold out hope and not talk about the child in the past tense. I mean, many missing children cases are solved by listening to the tenses that parents or guardians use, because statistics will tell us that most missing children cases involve a parent or a guardian or somebody who knew the child. I mean, stranger abductions do occur, but they're kind of rare.
We had a case up here, Mark, in Maine a number of years ago, actually before I lived here, where a foster mother had duct taped a foster child and killed her. And in a training seminar, we listened to the police interview of the now convicted foster mother for killing her child. And it was fascinating. The police did an excellent job, open-ended questions, a lot of active and strong listening. But for about 2 hours, the foster mother shied away from using the child's name, used some distant pronoun type names, that sort of thing. And then we had a break, and we came back into the auditorium, and a mother came up to speak to us regarding shaken baby syndrome, which all of us are sadly familiar with. And the program was called Don't Shake Jake. And her son, Jacob, had been shaken to death by a babysitter. And it was obviously not a premeditated murder. It was just someone lost a temper in a moment of time. But what made it so fascinating to hear her speak is that her child had been dead at least 2 years by the time she gave this this seminar. She still slipped into present tense language, and she would say, "My Jake, my Jakey, my little fellow, my wonderful guy." Lots of possessive pronouns, lots of the use of my, lots of terms of endearment. But Mark, she was still speaking, oftentimes in the present tense, as if he was still there. How rare is it for in these type of cases for someone to go into the past tense and not have it be a strong indicator for us? You know, could someone say, "Hey, that's just, you know, that's just a slip of the tongue"?
Well, I mean, are you asking me about her present tense language that she was using?
No, I think that was kind of natural, where she was just
right.
She was, you know, so mostly involved. But Casey Anthony, Misty Croslin's another one. I loved that little girl, past tense.
Right.
How strong of an indicator is that for us to follow? I guess Susan Smith would be another example.
Yes, she is another example. It's a very strong indicator, because as we said, it's not, a person can't say, "Well, I didn't mean to say that," because the rule is people mean exactly what they say. And something is going on in their mind which causes them to say that. Now, people may not have meant to say that in terms of, "I didn't want to hurt somebody by making a comment," but yeah, what comes out of a person's mouth is what they're thinking. And so it's a very strong indication when people talk about a missing person, you know, in the past tense. Now, in some cases, people are smart enough to realize, "I can't talk about her in the past tense," and so they will use present tense language. So it doesn't happen in every case where a parent or guardian is involved. But it does happen frequently because people, words betray them. They forget that I have to keep using present tense language because they know the child's dead, and so it's natural for them to talk about the child in the past tense. Now, of course, if we're not talking about a missing case person, then we expect a person to use past tense language. You know, tell us what happened. Tell us what you saw. Tell us what you know about whatever it is we're investigating. And so, therefore, in most statements, everything should be in the past tense. And it's present tense language that sometimes gives us a clue they may be making up the story. But with the missing person case, it's just the opposite.
Okay. We have a question from the chat room. I don't think I told you that, Mark. We have a chat room that comes up with the Blog Talk Radio. And,
okay.
Do you have any thoughts on the Zahra Baker case, the missing girl from North Carolina? Have you followed that at all?
I have not followed that, even though I live in North Carolina. I'm on the other end of the state, but I've seen that on the news. I have not looked to analyze any statements from anybody involved, so I can't comment on that case.
Okay, that was it's a fascinating case. It's a tragic case, but I believe the dad did use. She's missing. I think she's 10 or 11 years old, and she's missing. Her dad used past tense language. The 911 call starts off with, "Hi, how you doing?" from the dad, and eventually
yes,
he gets
I did
put
hear
down.
That.
Yeah, you did hear that one. Eventually, gets to what the reason of the call, and I think most people were just enraged, and they're expecting an arrest of both him and the stepmother. She's in jail now, and she's admitted writing the phony ransom note. So, another case have you had a chance to look into the Tiffany Hartley case?
I looked at the interview she did with Greta Van Susteren, and I was on the road when that story broke, and so I didn't have a chance to analyze a lot of statements, and a lot of people such as yourself had already been on it, so I was fine with that. But I did see the interview she did with Greta Van Susteren, and she definitely has, you know, there's some problems in her languages that would, you know, if I was the interviewer, I'd be, you know, backing her up in her story and trying to find out exactly what's going on. She has some changes in language. She talked about, she said, quote, "I had several bullets going over me and hitting behind me." And then shortly later in the interview, she says, "I saw two shots hit next to me." So she changed her language from bullets to shots. And as I looked at her statement, I couldn't find a justification for that change. She said, quote, "And I looked back and David was hit." And hit's kind of a soft term, but then later on in the interview, she said, quote, "And I looked back at my husband, and that's when I saw that he was flying over the jet ski." So now we have it changing from being hit to flying over the jet ski. So these are some areas we'd want to try to clear up and find out, you know, why is her language changing like that? Is there a justification for the change?
That was an interesting point because the flying over the jet ski apparently was a reflection back of the original 911 operator. The 911 operator apparently didn't believe her and had to re-ask her. So, you know, your husband was shot. But here's a statement for you that I think you'll find fascinating. She said, "There were three boats that were chasing us. Then one boat came up to me." They're supposed to be both in jet skis. So the three boats chasing us. Then one boat came up to me. And I saw two people in that boat. But there was a third or a fourth person in that boat. I just didn't see them.
She's telling us what she didn't see, and in a statement, a person should only tell us what they know, what they saw, what they remember. When they start talking about things they don't remember, it's an indication, and again, it's just an indication that perhaps they're making up at least that portion of the story. And of course, again, if she didn't see him, well, then how did she know there were a third or fourth person in that boat? And that's just, you're right, that's another area that we'd want to, you know, back her up in her story and try to find out what's going on. I think Greta had asked her how, when she left, asked her, "How close did you get to them when you drove past them?" And Hartley's answer was, "I honestly have no idea." And there we have the word honestly. We don't have God invoked in there, but honestly, but also the phrase "have no idea." It's very rare when a person can truly say, "I have no idea" or "I have no clue," because most people have an idea on just about everything. It may not be correct, but they have their opinion. And so it's very rare when a person can use a phrase like that.
Okay. We have a few more minutes, and I know there's more questions in the chat room coming through, but I did want to ask you a little bit about your course, Mark, because a lot of the listeners are inquisitive. They follow some of the crimes that are in media. They watch some of the news programs that come across. They're very informed people. And I've recommended, even for those that are outside any investigatory fields, to consider taking the course. I had, for those who don't know, I had taken a Mark's course a while back, and then I took it again. I enjoyed it that much. Can you tell them about the course a little bit?
Yeah, the online course that I have in statement analysis is the same information that I share in my one-day seminars. And it's a self-paced course. You have 90 days to complete it, although I'll give you more time if you need it. But it's at your own pace, but there are 8 lessons in a review. And at the end of each lesson, you have to analyze 2 statements that I give you and send me your analysis. And then I'll provide you feedback on, you know, what you saw, what you didn't see, you know, things to look for. And then each lesson is based on the previous lesson. We had a few more techniques to look for. And the next statement you're going to analyze, you're going to incorporate a few more techniques. And the response has been very favorable to the training. A lot of law enforcement people take it, but not just people who are conducting interviews. Like, as you said, just the general public who are interested in the cases that are on television, or even if just watching a murder mystery movie, you can usually figure out who did it in the first 15 minutes by using statement analysis. So a lot of people are taking the course. It's $99, so it's a very, you know, reasonable price. It's a lot cheaper than attending a seminar, and there's no travel expenses involved.
As I said before, I've taken the course twice. I loved it. As a matter of fact, Mark, I don't know if you – I was going to reflect back to you one of the course samples, but the security guard statement was one of my favorite test samples that you gave us. In that, because we have a statement by a security guard, and I believe, or at least from my point of view, that it's very likely that every sentence he said was true.
That's
there's
correct.
Not a single lie, sentence by sentence by sentence, yet he was involved in it. And I also wondered about that. I think some of our listeners are going to be familiar with that because they'll be taking the course. But he went out, and he didn't see any strangers, and give us indication that who we did see was not a stranger. But was that a case of someone that says, for instance, I heard a noise, I went out around the back, and I saw no one walking around.
Well, what you'll find, as you mentioned there, is that in an open statement where a person can say anything they want, such as, you know, tell me what you saw, tell me what you know, in an open statement, it's very rare that a person will lie, because they know lying causes an internal stress, and, you know, their non-verbs may betray them. So the safest way to play it is a person will give you a bunch of truthful statements. Of course, if they're involved, then they'll leave out anything that's incriminating. And so the rule is that as you're analyzing a statement, you need to believe what people tell you. And if you take that approach, you'll get a lot more out of it. Like you said, he said, I didn't see any strangers on the facility that night. Well, that's a truthful statement. Okay, you didn't see any strangers. Well, he didn't say I didn't see anybody, or I didn't see anyone, because that would be a lie. So he qualifies his statement so that it is a truthful statement. He said, I was the only guard on duty, which is a truthful statement. But there could be other guards who are off duty. There could be other people there who are not guards. But it was true. He was the only guard on duty, you know, that night. And if you take that approach, okay, I'm going to believe what you're telling me, then you don't want to be gullible, so you'd be very discerning, and you're going to get a lot more out of that statement.
What I thought was fascinating is that as he gave a statement on what happened, what's important to him is going to enter that statement. He talked about a baseball game, I think it was the World Series, and it seemed to me that one of them was from one area, and one of them was from another area, so they rooted for different teams. And if I were able to put myself as a fly on the wall, I could see those two, at least two of them, being a little bit sectarian, a little bit where I'm rooting for this team, you're rooting for that team. But then they both hate the boss and the economy is bad. And it seemed to me, Locke, as if they almost sat down and found some peaceful unity between them as they began to complain about their supervisor, because that was a negative reflection of the supervisor, and about their pay and about the economy. And I said to myself, boy, it sounds like these guys actually planned this while watching a baseball game together.
And that could be. I don't know that for a fact, but you're right. That's whatever they put in their statement, that's what's on their mind. That's what they want to choose to tell you. And, you know, they talked about baseball first, not security matters, but baseball. And then, as you said, they talked about the economy, so that we know they were thinking about money and we're investigating the disappearance of money. So it all starts to add up. And as you mentioned, they talked about the boss and didn't introduce him by his name, so it showed that they didn't like their boss.
One of the things that frustrates me, and I think I can say this clearly for a lot of the listeners as they write in, is that on some of the network programs, on some of the nightly news call-in talk shows, that sort of thing, is inevitably a retired investigator will say, I know that so-and-so is lying because their lips are moving, and then everyone will laugh, and then they'll dismiss everything the liar has said. And that, I think, is just the antithesis of what we're saying in terms of listening. When in the Casey Anthony case, and this is a fascinating example, in the Casey Anthony case, they had called in Tim Miller's Texas Equisearch to come in and search for little Kaylee, who Cindy insisted was kidnapped and missing. And so when are you familiar with the story, Mark?
I'm familiar with the person you're talking about, yeah, the Equisearch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, when they went to the house, Casey was out on bail and she was in the house, and she would not give them any indication of where they should search. And so they asked Cindy Anthony, the mother, said, you know, where should we search? And she wouldn't help. So they tried to get Casey to make a mark of an X on a map of Florida. And Tim Miller said, listen, I'm not from the area. I don't know much about Florida. Tell me where I can begin. Just make a mark. Put an X on this map. And Casey Anthony refused to. And obviously, in hindsight, we know why. But interesting enough is that Cindy Anthony got so angry that she threw out Tim Miller and his workers. She walked up to the microphone and she said, she was angry that Tim Miller might be looking for a body recovery. And she said this quote, George and I don't believe that Kaylee's in the woods or anything. And this is why her justification for throwing them out. Short while later, half a mile from the house, Kaylee's remains were found in the woods. So I look at that as, this is what was in her mind when she spoke. We need to be listening. Or when Casey was interviewed in jail, I'm sorry, not interviewed, but when she was in jail, those jail tapes, she said, in my heart, I know she's close. And statistically, we know that a child is going to likely be buried or left out in the elements somewhere close to the house. And sure enough, I don't know if it was a quarter mile or half mile from the house, right in those woods that she was found. Many people, and myself included, are frustrated when we hear that sort of dismissal where someone is known to be a liar, so therefore they're not listened to. How important is it for us to be listening to the words that even liars choose?
Well, very important. Again, if you take the approach, I'm going to believe what you tell me, and when Casey says, I believe she's close by, then okay, I'll believe that you think that. Well, the question is then, well, why? Why do you think that, or how do you know that she's close by? The same way when Cindy said, you know, I don't believe that Kaylee's in the woods. Okay, I believe that, but why is that coming into your statement then, this specific area, not very specific, but at least, you know, meaning the woods versus a more urban setting? And so, you know, it's not a clear sign that, hey, you're being deceptive or you know where your daughter is, but it's something that we have to take into consideration. And a lot of times it surfaces in hindsight, but even as a person saying it, okay, I'm going to believe that, and then it may raise other questions. Well, then how do you know that, or why do you think that? that, you know, we'd want to ask her if we were conducting the interview.
Okay, we're just about out of time. For our listeners, if you'd like to take this course, I heartily recommend it. But I think for those of you that are just fascinated by truth and fascinated by deception as I am, I think a great start is I Know You Are Lying. You can get it, I think, through the website. Is that correct, Mark?
You can get it through my website, statementanalysis.com. It's also available on Amazon.com. And at least visit my website, because as you mentioned, I have a page of famous cases, and a lot of them the people be familiar with. And just by reading the analysis, it's going to give you some insight into some of the techniques that we use when analyzing a statement.
Yeah, I think there you'll see generally some updates with the new cases. One of the recent ones you had up was Bishop Eddie Long, where I believe you showed that he was withholding information. Floyd Landis, regarding the cycling and the steroid use, and as well as some of the ones that are more famously discussed, like Michael Jackson and O.J. Simpson. So that's found at statementanalysis.com. And is that where they would sign up for the course?
Yes, there's a link for the online training and for the book, and I also have some software that will analyze the statement for you.
Actually, I forgot about that, Mark. That was a big help to me, especially in the beginning, when I would sometimes be moving too quickly and people get busy. The software will slow me down and highlight some words for me and help me to, as a good source of reminding of grabbing onto some of those words. Have you found many people liking the software? Have the reaction been to it?
It's been good, very positive. I haven't heard any negative comments about it. The one thing is the software will not tell you if the person is being truthful or deceptive. It just points out deceptive language, tells you why, it flags this word. You know, it helps an interviewer to with their analysis or with their interview. But it would be nice, you know, if we could develop software that would come out and at least give you a percentage of as to whether this person is being truthful or deceptive. It won't do that, but it will flag a lot of words and tell you why, you know, why these words were flagged, whether it's the pronouns or passive language and probably about 100 other things that it's looking for.
I found that it was useful at first guiding me and then later on in checking my work. And then now as a good reminder, especially on a long statement where it'll actually slow my work down so I can stop and take a good look. But I find it useful. And I wanted to one other point to make about that. When someone asks, well, you know, who needs this type of training besides law enforcement, besides investigators? And I think journalists would do quite well to take this course. We've seen recently in the Hartley case where some of these phrases have gone by without any follow-up questions. Counselors and therapists who really are trained to listen and to listen very carefully would benefit from it. And then, Mark, I add in any parent of teenagers could benefit from the training.
Yes, kids give us a lot of statements to look at.
I thank Mark McQuist for joining us. Mark, I appreciate you being on, and much success with the seminars and the upcoming trainings. Please visit www.statementanalysis.com and immerse yourself in some of those famous cases, which you'll be familiar with already. I think they're a great tool to learn and practice on. I'd like to thank everyone for being with us. We will not be on the air next Sunday, Halloween the 31st, but we're back on the following Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we will be back in again in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.